So good morning. I'm Barbara Chatterton Fry, the chairman of the Hospitality Committee and a Prairie member. We gather here today, our hearts alive with hope that here we will be truly seen for who we are and welcomed into the garden of this prairie community, where the simple and elegant, the fluted and frilly, the perky or somewhat wilted, the shy and the dramatic, complement each other and are treasured. May we know that here each contributes in their own way to the beauty of the whole. All are welcome, all genders, sexualities, politics, clappers and non-clappers, progressive or conservative. May we root ourselves in the values of this community, compassion, courage, transcendence, and justice. Just as Prairie is varied, so is our programming a mixture. We may have a presentation from our consulting minister, Sandy Ingham, members of the congregation, or as in the case today, a friend slash member, or sometimes outside speakers sharing a very wide variety of topics. So the opening words this morning, I propose an enabling conception of justice. Justice should refer not only to distribution, but also to the institutional conditions necessary for the development and exercise of individual capacities and collective communication and cooperation by Iris Marion Young. Next, Rachel and Martin will do the chalice lighting.
This is from the Article 1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood.
And now this morning, we're happy to welcome Peggy Small to our service this morning. Peggy has been a pediatric nurse for over 20 years. She has a master's in healthcare ethics, and she sits on the UW Hospital Ethics Committee. In her spare time, she knits. She's usually knitting, but today she's busy because she'll be up here. So welcome, Peggy.
Thanks. I do feel really weird without my knitting, so if I'm fidgeting, it's because I wish I was knitting. my notes. All right. So this morning we're going to talk about structural justice, and I think it's safe to say that everybody in this room would probably agree that we really like justice. We want justice. It's one of our principles. But then when you're asked to define justice or to identify when we have achieved justice, it gets a little bit more difficult. There's a lot of different theories and definitions of justice. And so today I'm going to talk about the theory and idea of structural justice. Structural justice arose out of feminist philosophy, and it espouses the notions of collective responsibility for societal structure and outcomes and elimination of oppression. All right, so you can, so this is distributive justice, and justice is often defined as fairness. And when we try to make things fair, we try to distribute things appropriately. And this slide is something I pulled off the internet, and you've probably seen something really similar. And everybody can agree that this looks better because they've redistributed the resources appropriately. Not everybody needs the same things. And so you give the people what they need to achieve their goals. This is distributive justice. But there's something still wrong. In the opening words, Iris Marion Young referenced an enabling conception of justice. So look at the person in the wheelchair. He can't reach the apples. And even if we redistributed the things like we did in the first slide, it wouldn't be any use to him. If he were given a taller box, he couldn't get up on that box, and he still can't reach the apples because he has different needs than other people do. Young suggests that we look at subgroups within a society that are oppressed and create a structure that develops and empowers people based on their needs and capacities in order to better the entire society. The person in the wheelchair isn't oppressed because he's in a wheelchair. He's oppressed because the purveyors of justice have not accounted for the needs of those who require wheelchairs. You can notice, too, that the person in the middle also benefits from the same thing that the person in the wheelchair benefits from. So by changing the structure, you've benefited all members of society, whether or not they're differently abled. In structural justice, we're going to look at the underlying causes of inequality. Rather than just giving people apples or boxes, we ask, why can't some people reach the apples? How can we help them reach the apples? Structural justice looks further into the causes of injustice and inequality in order to mitigate underlying structural injustices. Here's another illustration of how structural justice can benefit all members of a group, including those both with and without special needs. We're often very utilitarian in our solutions, and we seek to create the greatest good for the greatest number. The guy shoveling off the steps because most people need the steps, the kid in the wheelchair has to wait. But he says, if you shovel off the wheelchair, we can all get in. No, everybody can use the ramp. Shovel the wheelchair? Shovel the ramp. There's a library that I go to that has two individual bathrooms. One was labeled men, one was labeled women. The one labeled women had a changing table, the one labeled men didn't. These labels oppressed individuals who are not gender binary and oppressed male caregivers who were taking care of children in diapers. They took a piece of tape and a marker and they covered up the men-women labels and just labeled them unisex. You can pick whatever bathroom you want. Now everybody can use the bathrooms. It was such an easy fix that suddenly enabled a lot more people and made things more equitable. We often talk about vulnerable people and label groups as vulnerable populations, but vulnerability is often not an intrinsic factor. People can be made vulnerable by their circumstances. It seems like that's kind of a subtle thing, but it's really important. So, for example, a homeless person isn't vulnerable because of who they are. Maybe they're vulnerable because they lack adequate wages or because they lack access to mental health services. If we can understand what led to this vulnerability, we can start to mitigate these underlying circumstances that led to his current problem. Structural justice seeks to reduce oppression, empower marginalized populations, provide preventative care, enhance capabilities, and advance society as a whole. So Young argued that oppression was a major factor in injustice. She argued that distributed justice alone can't eliminate oppression and that underlying oppressions within a society need to be addressed in order to fully meet the needs of justice. And she had five faces of oppression: violence, exploitation, marginalization, powerlessness, and cultural imperialism. And I think the meaning of most of these is pretty apparent, and I'm gonna give you some sources at the end for like further study if you like. So the main one I wanna talk about though is violence, because when you think of violence, you're probably thinking of like a physical act of violence, like somebody hitting somebody, somebody, you know, doing some kind of hate crime, sexual assault. But there's also the idea of structural violence that's a lot more subtle. It's less apparent, it's not one big act. Structural violence is a systemic way in which certain individuals or groups are put in harm's way because of societal processes or structures that are in place. So structural violence is a food desert. If you live somewhere where you can't access healthy foods, you're put in harm's way. If you don't have access to health care, you can't get the care you need, you can't get the preventative care you need, you are now in harm's way because of the way our structures are in place, are keeping you oppressed and unable to benefit from what you need to do to live a full, meaningful life. Okay, so how do we know then if we're eliminating oppression and actually achieving these goals of structural justice? This goes back to the question of what is justice? Sen and Nussbaum are two philosophers who argue for a capabilities approach to justice. If we want to know if we're meeting the needs of justice, we ask these questions. What are people actually able to do and be? What real opportunities are available to them? This approach can balance individual or subgroup needs and abilities with what is offered by society to people. How do we enhance a person or group's abilities to give them a more fulfilled, meaningful life, to make sure they have real access to opportunities? All right, give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. You've probably all heard this saying before, and it sounds like it's structural justice because it offers a solution to mitigating the underlying cause of his hunger, but I don't like it. The problem is that it doesn't account for any other underlying factors or his preferences or abilities. Does he have access to a clean source of water that has fish in it? Has anyone asked if he even wants to or can learn to fish? Is he a vegetarian and he doesn't eat fish? We don't know. If we want to eliminate oppression, we need to hear the voice of the oppressed person and actually account for his values or her values and preferences. Another problem with this proverb is that it implies that it's an either-or situation. In talking about structural justice, we still need charity and we still need distributive justice. Those are important elements still. Structural justice doesn't seek to supersede those things. I like charity. It fixes an immediate problem. When we made the homeless kits with our RE kids, that fixed an immediate need for a lot of people. So we passed them out. People were so grateful because they needed socks, they needed money, they needed food, they needed those things that we provided for them immediately. It didn't fix their homelessness, but it was still really important and valuable. So think about the hungry person trying to learn to fish. It's hard to learn anything when you're hungry. This is why we have breakfast programs in schools, so that you can be fed and then you're in a better place to learn. So the charity is important in meeting that immediate need, and then we go on to address the underlying issues that led to the problem that we're trying to solve to prevent it from continuing or from recurring. Charity seems easier, cheaper, simpler than long-term justice solutions. For the sake of brevity, all the examples I've given of structural justice have been really easy things. The tape on the bathroom door, clearing off the ramp before you clear off the stairs. But the reality is that most changes needed to achieve structural justice are really complex, and they're heavily time and resource consuming. Healthcare, homelessness, poverty, it goes on. It's overwhelming. It can make you not want to do anything and just sort of crawl back in bed because it seems too much. To rebuild social structure that resolves these things seems daunting. Change takes time, it takes money. But the reality is that for many years, we have devoted huge amounts of resources to these issues without good resolution. Distributive justice doesn't necessarily prevent future problems. We can be willing. Structural justice solutions can be resource heavy up front, but if the focus is on prevention of problems, they can be time and resource saving down the road. If we look at the big picture and we can prevent problems, we're paying a lot of money up front to save money, resources, and help people in the future. We can be willing to devote these resources, but we also, again, need the voice of the oppressed to truly achieve structural justice. Giving voice to oppressed people is going to fulfill two purposes. First, it begins to reduce oppression simply by allowing voices to be heard and saying to people, we want to hear from you, we want to know what you need, and we want to meet those needs. That was beautiful. Okay, and then secondly, giving voice to oppressed people allows them to develop and communicate their capabilities and preferences. The voice of the oppressed is a fundamental element to elimination of oppression and development of solutions that resolve issues, prevent future problems, and don't perpetuate further oppression. Don't assume that that man wants to or can learn to fish. Offer a person a fish. Ask them if they'd like to learn how to fish, and if they want to learn, how can I help you learn how to fish? None of this can be achieved, though, if the majority doesn't facilitate it. A lot of people will balk at the cost of solutions or at the idea of hearing from those who are oppressed. So a final necessary component is a sense of collective responsibility among the members of society. People need to feel responsible for the problems of other group members and responsible for helping solve them. The entire society needs to be invested both resource-wise and philosophically in solving societal ills and achieving justice, understanding that benefiting someone else benefits society as a whole and therefore benefits me. It's a hard thing to convince people of. So these are my further references, and I'm going to leave this up here. These are all, Justice and the Politics of Difference is by Ayers Sumerian Young, who did the opening words and also talks about the five faces of oppression. Creating Capabilities goes further into Nussbaum's idea of the capabilities approach to justice. Inequality Reexamined is Sen's book on also related to like capabilities approach. Paul Farmer is a doctor who works a lot in underdeveloped countries and has a lot of ideas about developing better systems of healthcare. Any of his books are good, but I particularly like this one. And then those are a couple documentaries that are really good talking about oppressed populations, and the bottom one is particularly devoted to health things because mostly I know and talk about health issues as a nurse and healthcare provider. So I think now we'll open it to discussion. All right, thanks. I love that so many of these comments were on the idea of understanding others. You know, I think that's a really important first step in working towards things and helping people is understanding their needs. And I think everybody in this room is just so self-reflective, which is beautiful. In an ideal world, we would just eliminate the idea of others. You know, we would just do things that are helpful because that's the right thing to do, but it's hard to convince everybody. And so I think you guys are a little bit of an exception to most people. And so, you know, understanding others, but also that component of explaining to people how will this help society, how will this help you as an individual who doesn't think they need this thing. You know, you do need that piece too. Otherwise, you're not going to convince people to help this small subgroup, even though it does is the right thing to do. So, thanks.
Thank you very much. And now Aidan Small will read the closing words, which he wrote himself.
The only way to truly start a change is to speak and have your voice be heard. Everyone deserves a chance to try it and hear it, even if you hate everything about your voice, because all voices matter, no matter what you or others think about your voice. Those who speak out can start a change, even though it may not start right away. Even if someone doesn't hear it at first, you can count on the fact that someone will hear it, whether or not it's your God, president, king, mayor, stranger, family member, or friend. In the past, voices were heard from various people, no matter their ethnic background, gender, sexual identity, or other labels they had. Your voice matters, so speak it.
Thank you, Aidan. That was wonderful. Well, this is the end of our service. Greet your neighbors, have some coffee, go out into the world. Thank you.